We're in pursuit.
Welcome, both of you, Greg and Jeff, to the podcast. We're going to start off talking about the Ever-Evolving Truth, your podcast. What inspired you to create the Ever-Evolving Truth, and how has its purpose or mission evolved since you launched it?
Jeff, I think that one's for you. You started it.
Boy, that's a great question. I never intended to start it. It kind of just fell in our lap. I was doing another podcast, just kind of messing around with some friends in the comedy field. And we did an interview with someone who claimed that she was a psychic. Her name was Terry Coleman. And afterwards, a couple months later, she called me up and said that she had a story and she was interested in collaborating, and that story was about somebody that she went to school with, so she did know personally, but she had an inkling that she was faking cancer and using GoFundMe and Facebook to solicit donations. And that's where it all began. It was just kind of just we all got thrown into the fire, and it literally exploded. And we had no idea what we were doing.
And that was your story, the girl who was pretending to have cancer. That was season one, correct?
That was season one, yeah. Just we affectionately referred to her as JVC. She had a lot of aliases. Jessica Smith, Jessica Veronica Cornell. Those were the two main names. But yes, that was our first season.
And she didn't have cancer.
She definitely did not have cancer. That was one of my concerns in the beginning. Was like, well, if we're going after this woman, what if she does have cancer?
Man, I feel really bad.
Yeah. So the way we angled it was we set up an interview with her, knowing that we were all, based on the information that we were fed early on, we knew that we all had a good feeling that she was faking it, but just in the off chance that she wasn't, we marketed the interview to her because she was literally willing to talk to anyone. She was, she was vomiting her story to anyone who would listen. And so we marketed it to her like it was a single mom going through chemo, raising a couple kids and that kind of thing, just in case we had to pivot and she wasn't, she actually did have cancer. We could tell her story in that sense too, but she right into it. She bit it hook, line and sinker and gave us everything that we needed to prove that she was lying.
Wow. That's crazy. And did she keep her lie going? Like
still to this day.
Wow. Yep. At least she stayed true to her lie. I mean, at least she stayed true to that.
She's committed.
Her conviction was impressive.
Wow. And so how much money did she get from GoFundMe?
In the whole scheme of things, if you look at other similar stories where people were faking cancer, it wasn't a whole lot. I think it was between 10 and 15,000 between Facebook and GoFundMe.
Wow. It's a lot.
It's a lot. Yeah, absolutely. And, a lot of small dollar donations. And I still attest to this day that it's not a victimless crime. There's these people, even if they voted, even if they donated 10, 15, 20 bucks, because of, her lying and the scam, she might have prohibited them from ever wanting to donate to an actual real case where someone's fighting cancer. It's definitely not victimless crime. It was a big deal. The season it evolved into telling the story of just some of her other antics, because while we were waiting to find out certain information and we were trying to dig in deeper to the things that she was saying, because she gave us a lot of like documents that looked real, but when you really examine them, you could start to tell that they were forged or
faked. My god.
So while we were doing that, we were kind of telling her the story of her past, which was just cartoonish, and kind of painting this picture like she is the type of person that would fake cancer. And the cancer story became like went on the back burner for a while to tell the rest of her life story. And she's one of the most interesting people I've ever had the displeasure of getting to know.
And it captured a lot of people's imagination, because before you know it, Jeff's doing his comedy podcast, Pookie in Paradise, for a pretty small audience. And before you know it, I remember getting a text from you and you're like, we have thousands and thousands of listeners, and you're filming a spot for Good Morning America, right? Like it blew up.
Yeah. The press, the local press, the national press, we had requests for comment from newspapers in Australia about it. But Good Morning America came at the end. All the news came at the end after she was arrested and charged, because nobody wanted to touch the story. We brought this to the news in the very beginning, and they wanted nothing to do with it. They said, check back with us once there's an arrest.
And so she was arrested, you said?
Oh yeah. It actually lined up. Because everything, the interesting thing about this story, and it was completely by accident, is that everything that we were doing was happening in real time. Whereas like a lot of true crime, you're telling the story of something that already happened, like it's already played out. And so that was really captivating to a lot of people. And it made it just a little bit different than typical true crime podcasts. And overnight, literally I'm watching the listens and I'm checking them, because I'm like, I'm just obsessed with that kind of stuff. I can't, I'm like, are people listening to this? Is this really worth it? And like, we went from like 1,000 like local listeners who are interested in the story to all of a sudden like 7,000, 8,000, 12,000.
Oh my God.
Like in a matter of a couple hours. And it turns out that I always forget the name of this podcast. I would have to look it up, but Adam Carolla's wife and her Crying Out Loud. Yes. Thank you. For Crying Out Loud got a hold of it, and they started talking about it every single episode that they put out about what happened in on our latest episode. So that like drove a bunch of listeners nationally to the show.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, it's true overnight fame, if you want to call it that.
That's exactly. So then your show dives deeply into complex cases like the Anna case that we're going to talk about. Can you walk us through the process for selecting which cases to cover?
Oh, boy.
Oh, boy.
Oh, boy. Well, the intent after the success of season one was to continue down this road. And I would, to this day, consider us amateurs when it comes to this. I was also... I had also committed to going back to film school in Florida. So this is kind of right before COVID. We decided to try to squeeze in a second season because we didn't want to wait. We didn't want there to be a huge gap. We shuffled the team around a little bit. This is when I asked Greg to come on as a writer and a occasional on air voice. Because we were going to be telling more of a story this time, a story that's already been told in a lot of different ways. So I didn't want to rehash the same thing. Didn't want to do something that other people have already done. And Greg's a published author. His passion is in writing. He's a very good writer. And I thought he would be a huge asset to the team. At this point, Terry and I, that's the person who brought the original story to us, we're still very close and on a good working relationship. And even though her main line of work is a psychic, whether you believe in that or not, I'll leave that up to your listeners and you. Me personally, I don't know if I believe that that psychics exist, but I do believe there are people out there with certain instincts and intuition that might be heightened. And it, during season one, she led us down these paths that seemed at the time kind of crazy, but they turned out to uncover a lot of different things. There's no way that we would have had the success that we had without her. So I trusted her. And I trusted her to kind of let her instincts lead us in the direction that we were going, which we were looking at a couple different cases in the same area, Chester County, Pennsylvania. And Anna Maciejewska was one of them. And she said she had a dream or a vision of Anna speaking to her. And that kind of had us make the decision, like, this is something that maybe we should look into.
Oh, and then of course, to compound things, Jody, Terry is someone who kind of has her finger on the pulse of what's going to be controversial and what's going to get people kind of talking, whether it has total credibility or not. So she wanted us to take the angle of everybody's saying the husband did it. The husband's the number one suspect. Let's go in the angle that he didn't do it. And let's look at all the other possibilities. So we were kind of, me being brought on as a hired gun, as Jeff mentioned, after I wrote Solving Cadence Moore, which funny enough was about a missing woman and a podcast around that whole mystery case. And then here I am doing it in real life. It was like a life imitating art for real. I remember saying to her, boy, I hope we're not going to go down that angle because it doesn't look good for any theories that are not the husband did it. But it came as a blessing in disguise, really, because by us doing that, it allowed us to tell the story of every scenario, to basically make up a story that would fit every scenario. And I think it ended up making it a much more enjoyable podcast to listen to because it really got people thinking.
Had different ways of presenting the information. I think that's absolutely great.
I think it ended up turning out pretty well. Where it really sucked was that we just couldn't get many people to talk to us. Everybody that did talk to us, which was a fair amount, only would talk off the record. Nobody would go on the record. I think some people were told by the police, hey, you know, it's best if you don't talk to outside sources. I think some people involved felt already in ownership over the case. As sick as that sounds, I think some people did feel kind of like they were the gatekeepers for the story. And we just found ourselves hitting walls. And then we didn't make any friends by the fact that they found out we were investigating theories about the husband not doing it, because they were all on board with that idea that he did do it. So that was the really frustrating part. But even with off-the-record sources, we found out a lot of things that really never hit the news. And I think the point of pride for us at the end of the season, even though we couldn't solve the case, was that we had the first new news piece. I think it was 11 to 12 minutes long, the first new news piece on this story in over 3 years. And it was directly responding to every theory that we had talked about that was pissing people off. So we had an impact in the world because of the way we approached it. A small impact.
Hey, but there was still an impact, and you got people talking about her. Right. And so let's go into there, and then we're going to talk about the rest of your podcast and the rest of the stuff that you guys are doing, because you guys are so busy. So let's talk about Anna. And I don't want to say her last name, because obviously it's a very hard last name, and I've been trying to practice it, but I'm having a hard time. So those that are unfamiliar with her case, can you give us a brief overview, key details surrounding her disappearance, and what drew you to this case? Like, what made you draw you to this case? Is there a detail or an element that really caught your attention?
I'll let you start there, Greg.
Sure.
Because you're really good with the timeline and the specific details of when things happened.
So Anna Maciejewska was a Polish immigrant. She lived in America. She worked as an actuary as her a job for an insurance company. Basically, she met her would-be husband, soon-to-be husband, Alan Gould, in the early 2000s. They, from all accounts, including Anna's mother, had a very happy, healthy relationship. They got married in 2006. And everything was fine. Everything was hunky-dory, as they say, until their son, Andrew, was born. And then we got very clear stories. This made all the news. The mother, Anna's mother, Janina, said that everything was fine until the son, Andrew, was born. And Alan, the husband, developed eyes only for Andrew. And for people that were close to Anna at the time, we've talked to associates, friends, different people that I got to be really careful not to name because they refused to go on the record.
That's
but
fine.
We had a lot of people telling us that the marriage was terribly on fire with discord, and that Alan was essentially shunning his wife, trying to keep her away from Andrew. At the same time, in 2016, she had suffered what at the time everybody reported as a miscarriage. We got intel off the record, of course, intel later that there was more to it than that, that it wasn't a miscarriage. It was a more intentional situation than that. And that
contradicting information that it was an abortion from a credible source.
Okay.
Right. And you got to remember that Anna's family, I believe, was Catholic. And you know, that's a touchy subject. And also you have this husband who is obsessed on their son, and now we have a terminated pregnancy situation. So around 2016, Anna fell into a depression. And some curious comments have been made about the depression, which we can go into if there's time.
Sure.
But essentially, we believe that she fell into a depression. And come early 2017, she had been speaking to her parents about making a trip out to Poland with Andrew to visit them. And there was a period of time that the PTO was going to be taken. That was going to start on March 27th of 17. And that week was meant to be earmarked for the Poland trip. That Poland trip ended up not happening. The person that was texting, saying that they were Anna, texting as Anna, told them that it was because of trouble at work. Fast forward to the end of that week, all of a sudden, the first day of the week that she should have been back, what we believe was a text was made to her employer saying that she'd be out for yet another week, which was very much unlike Anna Maciejewska, who was extremely studious, extremely work-oriented, career-minded. And then she did not return from that second unexpected week of PTO, which would have been April 10th. And then her employers called police on the 11th, and then this whole thing started. Oh. Her husband, Alan Gould, told police that the last time he saw his wife was on April 10th, as she was walking out the door in a panic to get to work, and that he never saw her again. Obviously, there are people that believe that was not true, and she has been missing ever since.
Oh my gosh. Okay, and, so what are the critical points in the timeline that's leading up to her disappearance? As with your research, what have you found?
I think that, Greg, I don't know if you would agree with this, but the time from where she was supposed to take the PTO to when Alan Gould said that was the last time he saw her, I think that's the main key point, because there's so many inconsistencies around that PTO, right? Some say that it was Alan who said, no, you can't take our son to Poland. Some say that it was canceled. Some say that she even went.
Oh my God.
There's so many inconsistencies there and so many gaps, right? So if, you know, what we learned about who Anna was as a person from the very few people that knew her on an intimate level that we were able to talk to is that what I gathered, and again, this is just a guess, because without obviously talking to her, knowing her myself, I can only go by what the information was, but she doesn't seem like the type of person that would, if her vacation got canceled or if her trip to Poland got canceled for whatever reason, she doesn't seem like the type of person that wouldn't go back to work.
Right. If she couldn't go there, it's likely she would have been back at work. However, the weird part is the last trace that anyone saw of her, Jody, was the 26th of March, which would have been the Sunday before that first week of PTO started on the 27th. She was, we have traces of her badging in at her office, probably to collect files or paperwork or whatever, or a computer. And then she was not heard from by her employer after that we know of.
Oh my God.
The real kicker, though, here's the key dates that make everybody really start to get suspicious. And the what makes it worse is that the news at the time was contradicting itself.
Oh, my God.
So for instance, there's a 2017 article from Rachel Tross, NBC, and she says in there, on March 30th, Anna's father, Zygmunt, received a happy birthday text, and he does not believe that text came from his daughter. He believes that because of the Polish language mistakes that were made in the text, he doesn't believe it was actually Anna. But in that article from 2017, the line in there is that Anna abruptly canceled the trip during this call, which was called her last communication with her family. However, you look at another article from 2017 from Katie Kohler, who did talk to us. This is contradicted because the quote there is that on the 28th of March, the mother said, Anna, if you come, that's the best present. And Anna said, I have things to do at work. Janina asked if they could come on Easter. And this conversation was on the 28th. On the 29th, we believe that a text was sent to the parents again saying Anna couldn't make it out due to issues at work. Some believe she was already dead by the 29th.
Oh, my God.
Most people believe she died somewhere between the 28th and the 30th because, in other words, sometime between the last phone call with her mother and before the birthday message was sent with Polish mistakes to Zygmunt, the father. That's when a lot of people believe the actual murder took place. And here you are, a last minute call out on the 3rd at the beginning of the next week. And then Alan says, oh, the last time I saw her was the 10th, right when she was going to go back to work. And I don't know where she is. You can kind of see how all this starts to look a little fishy.
There is also the issue of her car. And I think our team did a great job of breaking down where her car was parked was in the opposite direction of where she worked. So if Alan did, in fact, if he was in fact the last person to see her and she disappeared that day, going to, you know, and she was on her way to work, she wouldn't have gone in the direction where her car was found. We also were able to uncover, and this might be a minor detail, but this is something I feel like if you watch television shows, whether they're fiction or nonfiction, this little detail that always leads to like breaking a case is that the car was backed into the space. And from what we were able to gather, Alan was the type of person to back into spaces. Anna was not. So why was the car found in the opposite direction? And I forget, Greg, do you remember how long after that last day that she was seen by Alan, the car was found? I can't recall.
I believe it was a month later.
Oh my God.
A month later that it was found. And the thing that we were told by eyewitnesses at Charlestown Meadows, which was that lot that the car was parked at, not only did people see the the forensics team, the investigative team that was out there, spend an inordinate amount of time, I believe, on either the right or rear front tire. I'm sorry, the right front tire, I believe it was. And looks like there may have been mud in the tread that they were investigating and seemed to be paying special attention to that. Could have been because they believe that would have given some idea about where the car had been right before that. The other thing about Charlestown Meadows is that if you walk in the wooded path back there, which originally some people thought she was buried back there, Jeff and I walked through that. There was no way, there was no possible way that somebody was hung there, buried there, killed there without, you know, the whole neighborhood on fire. You could just see the whole area. What's interesting about that area, though, is that it's only about a mile walk from Alan's residence. So if he was the one that dropped that car off after, let's say, disposing of a body, he could have parked it there at a place that Anna wouldn't have gone and he wouldn't have gone. Neither one of them lived there. And he could have walked back through that path. And a lot of people believe that's what happened. The big questions are what happened in between. How did she, if she is dead, how did she die? What are the reasons? And we went through all of that.
Okay. So she does have a child, correct?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. So where is Andrew now, with the father?
He lives with his father.
Oh,
that, yeah, that has never changed. And the other weird thing about this case is that the parents of Anna, at least at the time, I don't know what their status is now. I believe that her father was sick. They were both elderly, but they would make frequent trips back to see Andrew and occasionally do an interview or get an update on, you know, from the state police. They would always meet with the state police when they came back. But they had they would have holidays with the father, with Alan. they had a civil relationship. They had a working custody agreement, or an agreement that allowed him to allow them to Skype their grandson, a good amount. So it's like they didn't seem to harbor any sort of animosity, resentment, anger, hatred for the person that was most likely responsible for their daughter's disappearance and most likely death.
Which leads a lot of people to believe, okay, well, does that point to him not being the guilty guy? Because you could say, well, Janina and Zygmunt had to play nice if they hoped to see Andrew, because now Alan's the only lifeline there. At the same time, I can't imagine if I believed that someone had killed my daughter, I couldn't believe standing in front of them or looking at them without wanting to strangle them. So it does lead people to say, well, does this speak to them knowing something more than has been made public? And maybe they don't believe it's Alan. And so we had to look into all those cases throughout the course of things, because people were all asking these questions.
Okay, so let's get into that. Who do you think, if you play out different scenarios, which I'm sure you guys did, who do you think and what do you think happened to her? Do you think someone was responsible for harming her? Or do you think she's just missing? And do you think somebody else is involved?
Jeff, I can. You can go first, or I can take it. It's up to you.
Well, I was hoping you were going to ask a question similar to this, because being that we kept getting stonewalled at every turn, and our partner, the person who led us to this case, not only started to lose interest when her intuitions were starting to fail her, but she was really, really banging the drum for Alan didn't do it. And that angered the few people that were close to this case, or kind of took, like Greg said, like ownership of this case. It rubbed them the wrong way, and it probably caused us to be stonewalled even more. So it almost forced us to create these scenarios that could have happened. And even though we did it because we had no other choice, it started to feel to me like maybe we should have gone this way no matter what, just for the sole reason, by looking at things differently, looking at the different possible scenarios, since there is not enough evidence to charge or convict Alan Gould, at the time, 3 years after the disappearance. Maybe this could eliminate some of the questions in the Alan did do it scenario. So there was a couple scenarios, and I think in preparation for this interview, I re-listened to the season for the first time in years. Greg said something, or we asked each other, like, what was your favorite theory? And he's, well, not favorite, because
logistically talking about favorite
murder. But there was a couple that I found really interesting. I if you listen to the season, in the very beginning, we completely ruled out suicide as a possible scenario. And then by the end of the season, we kind of talked ourselves back into, well, if it were suicide, there are some things that could point to that being possible with the new information that we uncovered towards the end. Now I'm drawing a blank, but the one thing that that I did think could potentially be a scenario is Alan accidentally doing it and then finding help. When we got back into the suicide theory, the idea that Alan maybe found Anna, if it was suicide, and was so obsessed with his son, because we know that to be true, that he didn't want his son to experience that trauma, that at that point he hid the body, hid the suicide from everybody, and it would explain it would answer so many questions that we had, that all the other theories, even the Alan did it, which is the most likely scenario, like why wasn't he cooperating with the police? Why did he stop cooperating with the police? Why did he lawyer up? Why is he not showing emotion? Why isn't he helping to find the body? Why isn't he participating in the searches that they were doing? It would answer so many of those questions. And I just found like that would be a twist. That would make sense for how weird this case is. The fact that Alan is kind of detached from the social aspects of life, especially with people he doesn't know. Some people have suggested that he's autistic, which a lot of the character traits that he presents would point to that. But there was no official diagnosis. It would definitely answer some of the questions that we had that we couldn't answer going through the most likely scenario, which is Alan did it. Would you agree with that, Greg?
Oh, I do. The thing with the suicide potential theory, at first we thought it was laughable. It's like, well, what did she pay the guy under the bridge to take her car back before she jumped off of it? Get like the homeless guy under the bridge kind of thing. So we wrote a scenario where Anna wanted to disappear. And we laid out a very, I would say hard to believe scenario in which we made it possible that she could have done that. But then when we really started talking seriously about it, and especially after this piece of news, this rumor really about the nature of that miscarriage or the ending of that pregnancy, we thought, well, if she was terribly depressed, and like I said, her mother said that she sounded like she was in a bad mood the last time they talked. Her nephew, who came back for one of the first 2017 visits with the Polish parents, he said, we knew that she had been depressed, but we didn't know how bad it was, and that was concerning to us. We don't know why he was saying things like that, why it was so bad. We didn't realize it was so bad. We still don't know where that information came from. We can only make guesses about that. But if it was true that she was maybe even suicidally depressed, and she did commit that act in their house, maybe a drug overdose, maybe a bloodless kind of event, then it did make sense to us that not only could Alan have potentially dragged her into, you know, car parked in garage, drag her to car, take her somewhere else, if the son's not around, it was the only way that we could see family, friends, associates actually helping him. If he said, I got to keep this for my son, he won't be able to handle it, etc. Now, all that being said, I don't believe that's what happened. I believe that the most likely scenario, as careful as this guy, Alan Gould, is, he was an exacting, precise type of personality, very measured mind.
They were both insurance actuaries, so you know the amount of detail it takes to do that job.
Really hardcore, detail-oriented people. What I believe most likely happened is that discord in the marriage was on fire. Alan was focused completely on his son, pretty much shunning his wife. Who knows what the reasons were for that? There's no official confirmation of affairs or anything like that that is like the obvious, oh, well, that's why they were having such trouble. But we know they were having big problems. I believe that Alan most likely either planned or created a spot in advance. Now, there are mine shafts all over Chester County, where we had people on the Facebook coming all the time say, hey, have you guys thought about this area? You know, I bet the mob used to get rid of bodies in places like this, these shafts. There wasn't a whole lot of bodies of water that would have been good candidates in that immediate area. I believe a radio tower area was searched, a quarry was searched, the residences were searched.
Oh my God.
Charlestown Meadows was searched a few times. But I think most likely Alan planned or created a spot in advance and may have waited months to lure Anna there on false pretenses. In the actual podcast, we invent a story about a romantic date out in the woods in the Poconos where they used to spend their romantic times. And I laid out the scenario where he could have potentially planned a spot months in advance, marked it, knew where to go. All of a sudden, his wife and him are sitting there having a picnic. Before you know it, she's drank some wine that potentially has a drug in it. She's unconscious. If that's how it happened or some scenario like that, he can kill quietly and his victim has no defense and he has to drag her 4 feet, 6 feet to a hole, cover it back up, reinforce it 3 or 4 times, drive home. He never had to check in anywhere. He never had to leave a trace. He could have been home the same night. I think probably a scenario like that happened. The more messy version is accidental. Fight went real bad. Push, shove down the steps, hit the head on the kitchen island, what have you. And now his only thing is, how do I get rid of this body? And at that point, did he drag her into the car parked in the garage, take her to one of those shafts? Did he take her to some area, other area? We know she's never shown up again. So wherever it is, it was a really good place to hide her. But I tend to believe the most likely scenario is premeditated spot planned or created in advance, luring her there on false pretenses, no trace, really no trail. He's back home the same night. And if his mother, who he was very close to, was watching the kid that whole time, she never even has to say that Alan was gone. For all anybody knows, they were all together in that house. And no one can really say differently if no one knows where they were.
Oh, my God.
And a real quick point about those mine shafts. We had, and it was towards the latter part of the season where we had someone who We've spoken to about other things, and they prefer to remain out of the spotlight, so they never gave us permission to quote them. But that person has said to us that even they do not have the ability to search those mines. So if someone were to dispose of a body down there, it's lost forever. They would never find it. The police wouldn't, the military wouldn't, they wouldn't. There's like, those mines are so deep, they're so
That's scary.
Unstable that nobody could safely go down there and search. And that is probably the most credible source that we've ever come across. So,
And even that source told us, I think it was more than 2 years ago now, he said that the chatter was that they were likely to try to go after Alan Gould without a body. That was over 2 years ago. We have not heard a peep about that in the ensuing 2 years since then. So this one is even way colder than it was when we touched it, Jody.
And what's also weird about this case is, again, the most likely scenario is that in any murder case is that the person closest to the victim, a spouse, significant other, even brother, sister, that kind of thing. As you get further out, it's less likely, but it's usually the significant other. That person is usually not a killer or a murderer before that. So they have no experience getting rid of it. That's where the mistakes come in, right? That's where the fingerprints are left, the DNA. That's where they're nothing. They searched the house. One of the theories was that he buried her in under the sandbox in their backyard of this house that they just had built. They searched with cadaver dogs. Nothing. Nothing on the car. Like, Alan's fingerprints weren't on the car when they found it. Like, how does your husband's fingerprints not anywhere on your car? Like, they don't drive each other's cars? Like, that's just, there's so many little things. Like, how did this guy know how to clean up after himself? Like, this is what puts doubts in people's mind, even though no matter what we do, there's really no other scenario that is as likely as Alan doing it.
So because now she went missing and texting was popular at that time. So was there a last text message between her and her husband?
She has had no digital trace that we can verify. The last text that anybody knows of from her was likely a text to work on the 3rd. Many people believe that was a text made by her husband. We believe that as early as the 29th and 30th, he was potentially and very likely texting as Anna. I think the last digital evidence we have of her is her visit, her badging in at the office on the 26th, and then her phone call with Janina on the 28th. I don't believe there was any other confirmed digital interactions with her since then. And then her digital trace, the very thing that turned this from a missing persons case into a homicide investigation, was that she has had no digital trace since then. And she has basically fallen off the face of the earth. So even if she did run away on her own to start a new life, whatever, you know, run off with a lover, whatever the most wild theories are, there is no trace of her. Credit cards were never used again. She left her cell phone at home, but there was nothing registered under her name, no communications, no public sightings, nothing. She just disappeared.
She's also not the type of person to be running late or leave her cell phone anywhere. That is not something obviously anything could happen. There's always an exception to the rule, but not with someone who's an insurance actuary who lives on their cell phone. And the other thing, Greg, did we ever confirm that it was her job, her employer that reported her missing and not Alan?
Alan, I believe, reported it after the employer. I'm guessing on that one. I won't commit to that, but the employer reported it on the 11th when she was supposed to come back on the 10th. When Alan reported her, I'm not remembering off the top of my head, but
that's weird.
It was after.
So the thing that sticks out to me there, this is like another thing that'll keep you up at night, is that there's no way that an employer is going to report someone missing to the police only a day after, right? Like a no call, no show. Like I've been in management. We've had no call, no shows. It's like, we're writing up the paperwork to fire them. We're not worried about whether they're missing or not.
Right. That's true.
So their employer knew that this is so unlike her. And there had to be something else that we're not aware of in that large window where she went missing and between you know, the last day she was at work, her vacation, Alan reporting her missing, their lack of communication. Maybe she was in constant communication with her supervisor or her colleagues at work, even when she was on vacation. There was something. And again, I'm just speculating. I don't know for sure, but something caused her employer to be suspicious that there was something more than just her not showing up to work.
I think they were already suspicious because of that last minute call out the first day of the second week of PTO. And they're like, well, that's not like her at all. I think the chatter probably started then. And then all of a sudden, holy crap, she's not here on the 10th. And then they get together, they start talking, they probably raise up the flag to the upper management. And then before you know it, they're like, well, we ought to alert the authorities. And whether Alan did it right before or right after that, I am almost positive it was very close together. And I have a strong inkling that Alan called second. So if he did it, he was certainly trying to put a big old buffer in there, because the less specific you can point to as to when she actually disappeared, the bigger window of time he has to play with as far as alibi, as far as time to cover anything else up, whatever had to be tied up.
And she never went to Poland. So we know that she stayed in the United States. So she never.
Yes, that was just a wild theory. Oh. Some people are like, oh, maybe she went, blah, blah, blah. But no, there's no evidence whatsoever that she actually went to Poland during this time.
And has there been any major developments in the case since you guys first started covering it?
Sadly, I don't think there's been one. The last time was this chatter about going after Alan without a body. And we had some hope at that point. We're like, yeah, maybe we ought to do like an update episode or something. And if you look now online, there's less now online about this than there was in 2017. In 2019, there's less than there was in 2019. It's really depressing that the story's starting to die, I think.
Right.
So if nothing else breaks, I think this one's going to be one of those ones that just is destined to stay cold.
Well, the other issue with this particular area is that that there's no local police department. It's only a state police jurisdiction, and there's no state police barracks anywhere near Malvern, which is where this took place. So it's almost like an out of sight, out of mind. And, you know, the resources are being put towards other, you know, more recent crimes. If you look on the original, I don't know if you went and looked, Greg, at the original Finding Anna page, there's something once in a while, like on the anniversary or close to the anniversary, but 2023 was the last time I saw something, and nothing in between 2023 and today.
Yeah.
And one of the issues we had with that page too is that they claim to be doing all this stuff to find Anna, but and this isn't necessarily their fault. Like, how much more can you do? You're not a law enforcement officer, but they started posting the person who ran that page started posting like other missing persons articles and just being like, when are they going to find Anna? So like, it got away from Anna's story, the Finding Anna page. What you will notice is about the time that we started this podcast, there's nothing other than Anna articles posted on there, even though they're few and far between, and they get fewer and further between as the more removed you get from the project. They stopped posting any sort of other missing persons articles, and they just Anna stuff. So,
and it's okay. So right now, we're in 2024. How long has she been missing?
Since April 10th of 17.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So that tells you all you need to know. I don't think the police, well, for one thing, I don't think they're not actively investigating it anymore from what we know. But I think they just decided that, because we've also, the other thing too, is we've had, that area has had at least two, if not three different, elected district attorneys look at the case, right? It's something that, you know, it was big enough at the time for them to, you know, it was one of the first things that came across their desk, and none of them have decided to go after Alan without a body. So
even Crime Stoppers, which at one point around the time of the disappearance put up, I believe, a $30,000 reward for information. Yeah. And even that page, last I looked, was now inactive.
Oh my God.
So. And they barely got even, like, you know how a lot of times a reward will get you a lot of phone calls, but none of it's really actionable. I don't even think it got like fake information or terrible information. It just got like no information.
That's
like,
even no hits. It's even worse.
No, yeah.
So if listeners want to help or have some information, who should they contact at this point? Is there somebody in charge of the case still? And if they are sitting on some information that they feel like they want to come forward, who would they contact?
I think the Chester County authorities at this point are still your best bet as far as if you actually have real information. I do know NBC News, the Pottstown Mercury, a couple of different news outlets that were really all over this. You know, it, as far as reporters or a story, those would be your go-tos. But yeah, I would say Chester County Police. Can you think of anybody else that would be
Chester County? Yeah, the Chester County's DA's office was probably the best bet. Because I don't think the police are actively investigating it. I could be wrong, but I don't think there's an actual person assigned to the case anymore. That person could have moved on. I mean, we're talking a long time ago now, 7 years.
It's a long time.
So yeah, I would say that probably the best place to go would be the DA's office, Chester County, Pennsylvania.
And hopefully somebody will remember something or want to come forward, because I think the family needs resolution or no answers to what happened to their Anna.
I agree. And even if the worst case scenario is true and Anna did take her own life, and then this is just a cover up of a body, it's none of my business personally, but I feel like if that is what happened, the idea of hiding the truth of your mother's death from your son is a pretty evil thing to do, even if you're doing it for what in your own mind is the right reasons. So at best, they're keeping the truth, a very important, crucial truth, from their son. And at worst, he's responsible for his son's mother no longer being here.
So, and his son is living with him, with the monster that killed his mother.
Allegedly.
Allegedly.
Right.
So I'm hoping somebody will come forward, because, you know, somebody has to know something. And hopefully,
you're right. And the theme of the whole season was, you know, here's a woman who it didn't get a lot of national coverage because she wasn't as pretty as some of the other victims out there. Her name is very difficult to pronounce. So the whole theme of the season was say her name, Anna Maciejewska. In fact, the trailer to the season is just me with an echo just saying Anna Maciejewska like 1,000 times. So
that's
just
really brilliant to do that.
Just talking about it might spark, you know, some information that didn't happen. You know, your audience is different than ours, so maybe, you know, we reach somebody that didn't hear our take on the story. So just talking about it every once in a while could help.
Before we get into your other projects, so give us what does she look like? How tall is she? At the time of her missing, how tall was she? How much did she weigh? Just a brief. So if somebody happened to see her the day that she went missing, can you give us a brief of what she looked like? And then I can try to find a picture and attach it to the podcast also.
Yeah, you can find pictures of her on the Finding Anna Maciejewska page, the Fresh Eyes on Anna Maciejewska page. So all we have to go on are pictures. There's no real video that I've seen of her. So the pictures that we've seen are, you know, lighter blonde hair, short, almost like, you know, up above her shoulder, haircut, small frame, but not like super thin, if that makes sense. Is that how you would describe her, Greg?
Yeah, she was in her 40s. Just looks like basically a normal kind of mom type of person in her early 40s. As far as the name, if you do want to Google pictures of Anna, phonetically, it looks like Macy Juska. MacieJewska. So it phonetically it looks like Macy Justa, but it's pronounced Maciejewska. So if you do Google it, you'll see a lot of pictures. But yeah, basically
dress conservatively.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. If you wanted to picture an insurance actuary, you'd
picture her.
Right.
You'd picture her.
Picture would be right there. Yeah.
Well, hopefully there's some answers somewhere for her family.
Sure hope so.
These are the type of things that, like, it doesn't keep me up at night, obviously, but it's like you think about what are they thinking about? Like, does Andrew know? What does he know? Like, what does he think about? He's much older now, you know, he's old enough to know what happened, or what didn't happen, or we don't know, you know. What does his dad tell him? Like, those are the types of things that you think that you want answers to as a human being.
Wow. Well, hopefully you get some answers, or somebody gets some answers. So let's go into, you have a political podcast also.
Yes, the ever-evolving truth, which the season
it 2. It evolved.
Right, it evolved again several times. By the time 2020 rolled around, we decided to take it in a completely different direction, and we started to capitalize on the zeitgeist of the moment, and we started to tackle the most controversial political issues out there. And we did, I don't know, maybe 150 episodes. Jeff, you might know better than me, but we stopped doing that full-time about 2 years ago. And now I know that, you know, like I said, as we were talking, Jody, Jeff and I are, you know, work on independent film projects together. Like I said, I'm doing a YouTube channel, Sterner Stuff Brand Artistic Creations, which is free verse poetry, some social commentary. Jeff is can tell you himself about his own podcast project that he's working on, as well as some films, Jeff.
Well, yeah, the ever-evolving truth that like I said, it was right around the time that I decided to go back to film school in Florida. So I was moving to Florida. I wouldn't be around to be physically available for these types of investigations, if you want to call them that. And we just thought that with me in school, we kind of had a falling out with Terry, and she wasn't a part of it anymore. So there was really no one to take on some of the burden that it takes to do some of these stories. So we decided, you know, recording remotely, we can, you know, maybe have some success talking about some important social and political issues. So that went on for a while, and we kind of got burned out by doing that. As you can imagine, it's a lot to take on, even though it's not as demanding physically or, you know, demanding time-wise. So I personally took a break from podcasting in general. I started just focusing on writing some scripts. Greg and I wrote a short film together that made it into a few film festivals.
Wow, congratulations.
Yeah, well, thank you. My dog, who was in that short film, got noticed by a couple of USC students that were doing their thesis film about a pit bull that was used as a bait dog and found a couple of brothers from a broken home. And so they hired her to be in a short film, and now that's making its festivals, you know, rounds now. And so far so good, doing really well. And, you know, I have a short film that I'm in pre-production on, just looking for a location. My original location fell through. So that'll be the next immediate project. And, we're kind of, I don't want to say reviving the ever-evolving truth, but we're doing a post-election special that Greg and his wife are a part of, just doing interviews about how people processed and handled the election, thought, you know, what they thought about it.
Oh, so that's going to be the next one. So that's going to be your next.
Yeah. It's going to be a series of about 7 or 8 episodes.
Fantastic.
And then my personal Facebook page is just kind of dedicated now to talking about my film journey and I would say social commentary too. I can't help not to comment on that and stick strictly to film, but that's what the majority of it is. So I don't know. I don't know what's in the future for the ever-evolving truth. I've thought about it. As I was re-listening to Anna's season, I was like, you know, it'd be cool to try this again. I don't know if Greg ever felt the same way, but
oh yeah, yeah. I definitely. That's why I always come back for the less frequent ever evolving truth episodes that you do now. But I think, you know, I wanted to focus again on writing books and get back to that. So I'm working on a book right now called Culture War, and I think, you know, Jeff, really his heart was always in film. So we get back together to do political stuff. We did a non-political podcast about just, you know, success and what success looks like for the individual and what it looks like for people post 40 who are still trying to make something of themselves and go for it. We did an episode on that. So we're just kind of into a lot of different things, but I'm about personal betterment. I'm about trying to figure out what the heck's going on in this world. And that's what really tickles my fancy the most. So I think for me, it was like, this is now our center point where we intersect and get together and do some stuff. But Jeff is, you know, very focused on his film career. I'm very focused on the writing. So it's sort of like now we can get the best of all three worlds, you know, the major core passion. And then we come together to do these creative things as partners that work really well together.
I think that's great. And if you don't mind, you can email me the link to websites and stuff that you guys are part of, and your YouTube channel. And when I upload this, I'll put all your links on there also.
That'd be great.
I appreciate that. Yeah.
So I appreciate both you coming on. I really appreciate all the time you took. And if you don't mind, you can give me both your addresses. I'd like to send out thank you cards for taking the time and coming on.
Oh, sure. Should we email those to you as well?
Pardon me?
We should email those to you as well. Yeah. You don't want us to tell us our addresses,
yes,
right now.
Please. No, no.
You'll be the next missing person we're talking about.
Right. I don't want Alan Gould showing up in my house.
Well, thank you so much. It was a pleasure to meet you both. And I wish you all the best of luck in the future.
Thank you. Pleasure being here.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.